Hey folks, it's Mark here. It's still a pretty heavy week because we're still doing Turbo Folk, but the last two episodes are now complete and they are very good. So we really hope that you enjoyed our series of exploring Turbo Folk. We thought it was really informative. We thought it was really fascinating and we hope that you did too. To offset the heaviness of this weighty topic, this week we're going to go back to episode 210 and our first ever cover mount episode. What's a cover mount? Well, a cover mount is a CD that came free with a music magazine, and the music magazine that we chose for this particular episode was of course Kerrang, and it was Radio Kerrang Volume 5. That cover mount goes back all the way to 1998. So it's a nice little time capsule into the heyday of nu metal. And of course, there's some other weird bands like Backyard Babies and stuff like that as well. But yeah, anyway, hope you enjoy.
Yo, what's up? This is Craig from Sinlinians. Up until about a few hours ago, literally, I was just hanging out minding my own business in Australia with these motherfuckers from Unsung. Asked me to say some words about their latest installment of the mixtape. It's gonna be some dark shit. This is Craig Carrick, signing out.
Hey folks, welcome to the Unsung Podcast.
Yes.
Hi there.
Yeah.
Try to keep the energy levels up, guys.
We only Mark do that about five times till he got the necessary energy.
It's all organic.
I got my tap half on number three.
Spinning it around his head.
Yes.
Yeah, welcome to the Unsung Podcast. Part two of the Cover Mount mixtape.
We need a name for it, don't we? If we're going to continue this part, we don't need to do part one ever again, because that would be weird.
That would be weird.
But now, if we're going to continually talk about occasional...
No, I still like a cover Mount Zion, but that's
yeah,
me.
Maybe.
I think that's
we'll discuss this off air.
Yeah, definitely will.
It's a soft no.
It's not that I don't like it, it's just that there's reasons why we shouldn't use it.
So the format of last week's show was that we took a dive into the history of cover mounts. What are they? Breaking apart the term, looking at flexi discs, looking at cassettes, looking at CDs, and chatting a little bit about, first of all, the fact that nobody seems to be able to work out how exactly they worked, and we're still looking into that, but also what impact they had on us culturally and what's been lost since they stopped being a thing and were replaced, or some super CD'd, let's give it the benefit of the doubt, by playlists. Whereas the format of this part two, will be the four of us, in this case, looking at a specific cover mount. Now, we chose one in particular for reasons that shall hopefully become obvious, but we're going to go through it, maybe as we would a normal album, analyse track by track, see what funny roads they lead us down, and try and pick something of a good, the bad and the ugly, you know, the highlight, the low light, and maybe just something unusual, something weird, an anomalous track, an anomalous band, a band that has some weird bit of lore about them or whatever. But for the purposes of this episode, we wanted to kind of start off hot, and we selected Kerrang Radio Volume 5. Quite a distinctive looking cover mount disc for people that know it. And also, as we mentioned last week, the choice for the first episode of another podcast, really good podcast.
Yeah, the guys from We Dig Music do a monthly podcast called Free with This Month's Issue, where they talk about cover mount CDs and they get people in to talk about their favourite one. And very oddly, we only discovered this like an hour before we did this episode, they chose exactly the same CD
to kick off their entire
for their
thing.
First one.
Yeah, so...
And a shout out to Mosher Mags on Instagram. I think it's...
Oh yeah, that's Mosher class. Mags.
This girl called Rachel, who's guested on their podcast a couple times. And that is... I think I sent you a message saying pay dirt. Because seems to have all the posters, all the stickers, all the things. And I think even just a couple of days ago, she put... she's doing free February. So it's all the free stuff. he used to get with magazines. So she's got these amazing Instagram pictures of all the cover mounts, all the posters, all the stickers and all the rest of it. So check that out. And probably a good shout for a guest for you.
That's pretty
for
cool.
Down the lane as well.
Yeah. So what that makes me think though is there must be a method to my madness when I sort of said, let's do this one, right? For me, I picked Kerrang! Radio 5 because I thought it had a good mix. You know, it has some kind of
It's got quite a bad mix at some points as well.
I mean, it's 1998, right? So it had the kind of stodgy new metal of the era. It had the kind of hints at cyber metal, but it had some of the emerging Brit rock scene or the early buds of the Brit rock scene. It had post-grunge, some awkward post-grunge, and then it had a bunch of other kind of very confused and ill-suited things, as well as a couple of bands that were actually a wee bit of a throwback to some extent. So it just seemed like a nice sort of blend, and some of these bands went on to do really well and others just sank into obscurity. So yeah, I mean, I can only assume that there must have been a reason they also chose it, and hopefully it's something similar. Maybe we can find out by listening to that show now. Let's have a wee look at it.
Yeah, let's get into it, man.
Craig, did you know this one?
Yes, this was 98. I was 16 years old, and this is one that I think I remember the issue quite well, actually, because I was into Sepultura.
Yeah.
And Max Cavalera was doing this new band called Soulfly, and he was on the cover. And obviously love Deftones, and we'll talk about that. Chino Morello comes in and does the intro. But yeah, I was really keen on hearing what Soulfly would be doing. I'd heard one track before this.
Yeah, I think Bleed had been released as a radio track.
Yeah. I think it had been, and I dug that, to be honest.
Yeah, but like as we were saying in the previous episode, I think sometimes labels or bands would take the opportunity to like sort of grab the front page and the you know, the cover mount CD and go, all right, we are launching either a CD, you know, a new album, or in this case, even a new project.
Yeah, and that was very cool, and it was such a, it felt like a strange choice that. Chino Moreno did the intro, but there wasn't a Deftones song on it. Obviously they had Adrenaline out in 95 and then Around the Fur in 97, and there's a little sample of My Own Summer, Shove It or whatever you want to call it. But this is before, you know, Deftones became White Pony Deftones, you know, and were massive. So this is the, how cool was Chino Moreno in 1998? That's a kind of a question.
I think they were still quite a new metal band, though. They hadn't like outgrown that, but they were a cool new metal band.
I think a more important question is, how rough is Chino Moreno?
Well, or how high? How baked is he? He's either hungover or baked.
What's up? This is Chino from Deftones. Up to about 5 minutes ago, I was just minding my own business, hanging out in London. And these motherfuckers from Kerrang! Burst in and asked me to say a few words and welcomed you to the latest installment of Radio Kerrang!
From the sound of it, it sounds like the Kerrang! Journalist is probably interviewing him before a show and then has gone, oh yeah, you know, like I remember doing it on student radio, like, oh, can you just say, I'll listen to student radio, I'm Chino Moreno. So Kerrang! Have obviously just come in and said, oh yeah, we're doing a strange cover mount CD, can we do this? We cleared it with your PR first. So he doesn't know what the fuck's going on.
I read that anyone who was on the CD had to be in the magazine in some way, shape or form.
Yeah.
And this is, so Deftones were probably in there and editorial somehow. I don't have the magazine, but I imagine they would have been.
I managed to go through a few pages of it online. I don't have the magazine, but there was like somebody was selling a back issue and it had a few pages of it.
But yeah, there would have been such a nice segue, which we'll get into when we go into talking about the Soulfly track. But obviously, there would have been a really nice segue from Head Up. Deftones and Max Cavalera.
I find that really surprising.
Head Up's an album track. That would have been one of the cheaper ones to put on the CD. But I wonder why that didn't happen.
I don't even necessarily mean that they should have included the song. They could have, perhaps. But I'm more surprised that they didn't have some sort of reference to the fact that Chino and Max had worked together on things. Did Moreno appear in Soulfly as well?
He was on the album as well.
Yeah. Jumped the fuck up, wasn't it?
And vice versa. So I thought,
but the thing is, they might have recorded that 2 months knowing exactly. The CD was out, but not knowing what was going on.
That's what I'm led to believe. Like, that's what I would assume, because otherwise, it's such a good opportunity for Chino to say, "Oh, there's this sick track by Soulfly up next, Great Band." You know, it's like there's no referencing to anything on it.
The music's loud and it's free. You got tons of cool shit on here. I guarantee you it'll sound even better if you turn your stereo all the way up to 10. So enjoy Radio Kerrang! Volume 5 and keep your ears open for more noise from Deftones soon. This is Chino Moreno signing out.
I mean, he really kind of be fucked.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's, as you say, Craig, I think he still had good currency. I mean, Deftones, even though they weren't quite the thinking man's new metal band at that point because White Pony hadn't come out, they were definitely better than most. And they had a kind of, they were less stodgy, they were more of a skater new metal band, you know, even just their look. Mm-hmm. They had a lighter touch with their...
And they had Be Quiet and Drive, which was like a big epic song. And I think women liked Deftones.
Shock. You wouldn't catch them on this podcast this week. You know, the thing is, just a Deftones intro, it's worthwhile to even have just this guy's voice on there. And that
really, I also just quite like the gimmick of Radio Kerrang, and they were like, "Oh well, we better have somebody introduce it like a DJ." But I mean, that's it. It's like a minute of somebody introducing it. And this would have been one of the last Radio Kerrangs, I think, because then just the cover mount CD became as much like, "Oh, just get on the cover mount CD." They didn't have to pretend to be a radio show or whatever.
Yeah, and Soulfly were on the cover as well. I'm just looking at that on my computer now, and it's free monster CD kind of thing, and it's Soulfly, the whole band, on the cover, who apart from Matt Cavalera are essentially kind of nobodies.
But yeah, Soulfly, no. Track number two.
So, you know what?
No.
I think this has aged pretty well.
No. Absolutely not.
So, Soulfly, you know, Max had left Sepultura, but they'd done Roots, which was pretty much a new metal record. You know, it wasn't thrash metal anymore.
Yeah, it's a progenitor. Yeah.
And then, so Soulfly was his new project. And it's interesting listening to this, and you're like, Slipknot don't really sound like Korn. Slipknot sound like Soulfly. And, you know, at their sort of bouncier new metal bit, like Soulfly, pretty much the peak of that just bottom bouncy new metal. And I think they're very fun. I think they're fun. I genuinely think they're fun.
I think he had like a 4-string guitar or something at the time.
Yeah, he only had 4 strings on his little ESP, ESD sort of thing.
Like, this is catnip to me. Like, the song starts off with just teenage rage, and then the line about no motherfucking hoodie and the blowfish.
I did enjoy that, to be fair. I did enjoy that.
No, am I losing my mind here, or does he sound like Arnold Schwarzenegger when he says that? No motherfucking hoodie and the blowfish.
Yeah, get to the chopper. Yeah. But Soulfly, if you think about it, they're a pretty unique band. You know, they've taken, like, Sepultura were a unique band, and then mix that with everything that's going on here. All the, you know, like Bleed. Like, Bleed is probably the only time I actually liked Fred Durst, to be honest. I think it was good. You know, their first album didn't come out until after this. I think the first Soulfly came out in April of 98, and this CD was February, so it was kind of a big deal. I think I might have heard Eye for an Eye, which is a fucking banger.
That's a good song.
That was on another Covenant CD, I think. And yeah, Bleed's awesome. I've got a story that will relate to you, Chris, about that tune, Head Up, we were talking about. I think my first ever band audition was playing bass for a band. I can't remember the name of it. It might have been Defect. most likely spelled wrong in a nu metal kind of way. Mm-hmm. And
I remember
featured one of your long-time drummers, Pete Flett, who's a bit of a Glasgow guy. And there was this other guy who sung. He looked like an amalgam of Zig and Zag. He was called Chris, maybe, on vocals. Anyway, I was trying out to be the bass player, and I had to learn a few songs. And I had to learn Roots by Sepultura, 10 Ton Hammer by Machine Head.
Classic.
And Head Up by Deftones. And I don't know, I can't even remember if they had any original songs.
The best of,
and it only
really
lasted one gig before getting the old heave-ho. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I got the elbow because I was just rubbish or because I broke my strings going fucking moi at the gig, or because I was just too much of a schemey. Anyway, I can't really remember too much as I was about 16 at the time, but encouraged me to learn guitar instead and make more terrible music.
Yes, I think I'm fucking mental, right? But see the simplicity of the riff in this.
Mm-hmm.
This is this thing that nu metal did, right? There is a pop simplicity to that riff.
Yeah.
It's like, if the Yeah Yeah Yeahs played the doomiest, slowest, dirtiest music, there's a silly, easy accessibility to that. It's like really, really simple, effortless.
And there's the looseness in the drums as well that's like,
yeah, it's just like Roots, you know.
Aye,
that's
totally.
I say Roots is that progenitor.
I think that one of the sad things is that I think the bridge in this tune weighs it down by being kind of glommy and sort of a bit saggy, you know. It is the nu metal of this. It's actually quite, I honestly can't believe I'm saying it, but I think it's quite decent until that bridge just burdens it like a big fat beer belly of a bridge. I just don't like it.
Cavalera's scream is obviously iconic, right? And it's just, and the sound of this band, that kind of weird Brazilian world music thing mixed with metal, then nu metal kind of thing, it's just kind of weird and cool, but it's of an era. It's maybe the best one on the CD, but I'm not going to count my chickens too early. But we have to talk about Ross Robinson. This is his era. He fucking dominated.
Absolutely.
Hang on a second, though. Before we go on for that, I just want to check. Do you think when they shat on Hootie and the Blowfish, not once but twice in the song, it started a flame war? Where, like, Hootie started, like, Mark, calling out.
Mark, have you ever heard of Hootie and the Blowfish?
Yeah, of course.
Have you?
You should see his face.
I think this very much dates it in a very specific way, where it was like kids these days would be like, what the fuck's Hootie and a Blowfish?
Yeah. One thing that I couldn't go over on this song is like how they've made the guitar sound like so super unaggressive, despite the fact it's heavy. It just feels like they've shown off all the rugged edges, so it's just like a fucking wet fish.
Oh, it was so amazing when I remember seeing him on their first tour live. I think they were supported by Glassjaw, and this would have been 1999 maybe at the Garage, and they had all the guys from like Nailbomb and all that. It was so visceral, disguised with like these big kind of Kerry King style like kind of nail armor kind of things, just like absolutely going for it. And it was and they were playing all these insane instruments, these kind of weird Brazilian instruments that they would hit with a bow, and it had a kind of just really kind of ethnic looking instruments with this like obviously super heavy metal kind of Max Cavalera, one big dreadlock screaming his fucking arse off covered in acne. It's just amazing.
So Ross Robinson,
he also produced the next track, did he not?
Oh my god. He certainly produced it. The next track, Goodbye Cruel World by the band Cold, was pitched directly at me, I think, at this point, being that it was basically a blend in Nirvana and Korn.
Yeah. The guitar sounded like a fart in a jar.
Wait a minute.
I mean, it does not sound like Ross Robinson because it sounds really bad.
Well, wait a second though, right? So I loved this band's first album at this point. It was really simple, just had their name in the front, red cover, blue logo thing. It had this gloomy grunge that sort of vibed a bit like the track Jimmy from Enema by Tool. Yeah. It was like a full album of that tune, which I was quite into. But what the fuck is the guitar and bass tone? It's a tractor about to stall. It's tectonic plates sped up. It's like pushing mountains around in the ocean floor. It's such a strange, grindy, unmusical sound that somehow underpins this song. And the chorus is weird because other than those like few picked notes,
it has no hook.
There's almost no guitar that you can actually hear. You can hear that grinding sound, but all the mid and all the actual tonality of the guitar has been stripped out. And honestly, the thing is, though, I fucking loved it. I mean, I loved this band. I really liked that. That was a really corn, sort of down-tuned, dirty approach to sort of bleachy Nirvana. And I was really fucking sold on that. It's got some really heavy China cymbal use in the bridge, which was total bang on 90s new metal. And the band themselves, you know, they didn't last even into their second album. I got their second album, but I did that thing where I listened to it but knew it was crap. You know, you were both trying but aware that this was not going anywhere and that you weren't going to keep it.
So you talked about the name on the cover. They used to be called Grundig, which you might remember, Chris, which was a brand, like a German brand of like VHS.
I had a shite TV, Grundig.
And I hate to bring up bloody Fred Durst again, but he's responsible for this pish because he handed it to Ross Robinson, a two-track demo, when they were called Grundig. Grundig, the German company, tried to sue them something for like $300,000 or something. So Wes Borland, also from Limp Bizkit, said, why don't you just call your band Cold? And they went for it. But excuse the pun, but yeah, this track leaves me cold.
I think by saying the guitar sound like a fart in a jar, the reason I'm saying that is because the vocal is pure butt rock. So if you follow the simile here,
well, yeah, I was going to say there's definite butt rock vibes to this. It's new metal meets butt rock. So.
Yeah,
I heard butt rock in a previous episode. Can you give me a definition of it?
It's basically Midwest
Scott Stapp,
post grunge, post Creed sort of stuff. So yeah, it's everything from Creed to Puddle of Mud to Nickelback.
Need of a Dead Man.
It's basically if you've got a pickup. And you live in Ohio, then it's butt rock.
So his voice is so overwhelmingly that it does sound a little bit like he's sort of eating peanut butter or something like that. At the same time, it's he's overemphasized it so much. I mean,
he's nearly got quite a English accent in it as well.
Yeah.
So the real.
Yeah, you're right. It's like an English person putting on an American accent.
Yeah.
Oh, that's strange.
We spoke about that vocal technique at the grunge episode. Do you remember what it was called?
Yeah, I can't remember now.
It was actually my wee brother that said in the crowd what it was called, and I can't fucking remember. Something vowels it was. Anyway.
Okay, next up.
Let's get serious. Dave, how about you take this one?
Self-Healer by Idlewild. So that's from their debut mini EP, Captain, or mini album. And yeah, fucking hell. So this was when Idlewild were
rocking.
Famously termed by NME as sounding like they sound like a flight of stairs falling down a flight of stairs. So well done to the NME for that. This was when they were raucous as fuck. I guess, you know, pre-folk, pre-REM and all that.
You know, it's naive as fuck. The writing of this song doesn't make a lot of sense, but works.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a bizarre, like, the drum beat, the way that the guitar falls on the accent, the fact that the clean guitar comes at the end instead of at the start. And...
a song is a beautiful lie. A song is a beautiful lie. And I know that one day when you die,
it's very counterintuitive, but yet I mentioned this in part one. There were songs that took a while, and I probably wouldn't have gone into Idlewild if I didn't have this collection on repeat. And slowly I realised, like, that's fucking great. It's really weird. And
yeah, because within the chaos, there's very sort of subtle melodies that
there's
you can
good
hear.
Good melodies in it.
Good melodies.
There's a good melody at the end, especially.
Yeah,
it saves
lyrical
it.
Content's amazing yeah. as well. It's mm-hmm. like, this track is so urgent. It's 1:58 and Aye. it's on a Kerrang CD, and it's heavy, but not that heavy.
Yeah, still, they're still an indie band rather than a metal band.
Yeah, but this was the introduction to Idlewild.
Aye, totally.
Another shout out to Scott D. This is probably the first proper gig I went to. It was King Tut's. It probably was 98. It's the first time I crowd surfed. We've talked about my crowd surfing antics on this show before. But yeah, Scott D put me up and I had my first ever crowd surf to Idlewild at King Tut's. And it would have been 98.
I think A Song Is a Beautiful Lie is one of his best moments in terms beautiful. Of just nailing yeah. the...
Because he started believing his own hype as a poet.
He definitely
which we
definitely
talk did. About. But like, yeah, I mean, they were just still barely teenagers here, so...
Mm. You know, there's an interesting contrast here as well, because this represents such opposing ideas of what is subversive and also opposing sort of takes on what people got from Nirvana, right? Idlewild have gone for this snotty, punky awkwardness, right? Whereas Cold, which is very much making nods towards Nirvana, but has extracted all the stodgy conformity and all the kind of appropriated, grungy, capitalism, you know, Cold have taken from Nirvana the stuff that I think even Nirvana weren't very keen on, and Idlewild have taken the stuff from Nirvana that is probably truer to the spirit of the band, despite not having that croony, you know, closed vowel thing.
Yeah, closed vowel, that's it, yeah, you're right. I think for me, I looked at the track list and went, Idlewild? But then you hear the song, you're like, oh, it makes sense,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
It's really aggressive and raggedy, you know.
I don't know if they ever appeared on another Kerrang CD. They did get good reviews.
They were in the magazine,
But I don't think they ever quite fitted in, and I can't
imagine.
They
would have moved to Mojo or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that,
I can imagine even on 100 Broken Windows, their label was probably pitching to, you know, Melody Maker rather than Kerrang.
I know there was a kind of honeymoon period as well, though, around about 2000, because I remember I was reading the magazine on the bus to university, and... Mogwai started making appearances in Kerrang as well, you know, getting double page spreads about them. So there was a kind of awareness of the Scottish sort of, not in fact, not just the Scottish, but a number of Scottish bands. You know, the band Foil, I first got into them via Kerrang as well, and they were getting some pretty, you know, decent reviews. And I think they're a band that probably should have done better as well. We'll talk about them in future, I'm sure. But nah, I mean, Kerrang had time for Idlewild, but yeah, you're right. At this stage of their career, they got far too slick later on to make it in.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't say if that's true or not, but I definitely seen You Held the World in Your Arms on Kerrang TV.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
And that was the big video, the one on the bus and that kind of weird guitar drop on it. Yeah.
A Modern Way of Letting Go was a big one as well, you know, because it was really heavy and fast. And American English was even on there, I'm sure. But that was when they started to get into the folky stuff, and then it just didn't. It was nearly like.
But Kerrang TV also, you know, like, used to put on Gorillaz and.
That's true.
You know, they were looking for content at some point.
I was just going to say as well, it's quite funny that this has got the most aggressive guitar sound of the first three songs.
The first three songs are,
you know, quote-unquote metal songs.
So there wasn't a huge amount of Scottish band coverage, but a little bit. There was a lot of Swedish band coverage.
Oh,
my goodness, yes. So... Craig,
I have no shame here. I love Backyard
Yeah, so I know you like the Backyard Babies, and they were it was a kind of music that I just never got. So see that entire world of like helicopters, Backyard Babies, even over here we had like Torquemada and bands that sort of tried to take that sound and make it their own as well. So it's a strange thing here. At the time, I really didn't like it. Right, I thought it was so boring and traditional, and it was a kind of timeless sound, but in a way that I found very uninspiring. And yet the timelessness of that sound means that this track has aged amongst the best of all of the songs on this, because that rock and roll thing is just so archetypal.
It's the same. So they were such a staple of the kind of mid-level venue scene from probably 98 till probably even the mid-2000s. Mm-hmm. And we you and I, Chris, probably were quite exposed to it in Glasgow with bands like Torquemada. A lot of our mates were in those scenes where it was that kind of guttural rock and roll, spitting eyeliner, tap saff, leather jacket kind
of fucking hankies and tattoos and shite.
Yeah, yeah. And I saw them either headline or support someone probably literally every few months when I was young. Dragon, obviously being the standout, just cool looking cunt. Super low slung guitar. Also, you've seen him every other month for the Helicopters and stuff as well, and you can't go wrong with that same riff, that which is that bend on the E and the D for pretty much every song. Yeah, this song is probably their highlight. It's a good club banger. You can play it in a club as well. Little anecdote, I mean, seen them playing with a band called the Famous Monsters. Don't know if you remember them.
Yep.
They were a kind of surf rock band, and they had Sean Jules from White Zombie in them. Another shout out to Scott D. We were kicking around with a camcorder back in those days. Mm-hmm. And we were big fans of the Pantera home videos. And in one of those videos, Pantera playing a gig with White Zombie, and Sean Jewell from White Zombie says, "Stop filming and start partying," on the Pantera video. So out the back of Tuts when we were about 17, I think, we got her to say the same thing on our camcorder, and at that time we thought that was the coolest thing ever. So that was a good time.
I mean, there was just a never-ending supply of this kind of music, though. Like, I'm not saying that Backyard Babies weren't a good example of it, but there just were so many.
But they had grown up watching Motley Crue happen.
Yeah.
So they were like, well, I want to just keep doing that.
Yeah, I mean, they're still...
Hanoi Rocks was a big one for
Hanoi Rocks. Yeah, totally. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. I will say as well, I remember girls liking this. And to be honest, that was such a fucking male-orientated music scene at that time that, you know, fair play.
You know, this band started in 1989 and they've still got the same lineup today.
That's fucking mad.
Pretty incredible. I remember them because one of my best friends, he's a huge fan of this kind of like Scandi rock and roll. To me, this band are no Helicopters, are no Turbo Negro. They're fine, but I think those two bands do significantly better. But I think the song's all right.
These guys are sexy as fuck, though.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Like, I guess the Hives and stuff, they put the suits on. These guys took the taps off. And that was, I guess that's why chicks dig it.
Yeah, I think they ended up being lumped in with the whole like Hivesy Scandinavian thing just by dint of that happening. But that was a few years after this.
Yeah, it was. Mm. So then there's a really anomalous track to me, 12 Rods and the song Red. I knew virtually nothing about this band and I had to investigate them.
I'd never heard of it.
No, they're from Minnesota via Ohio. One of them ended up playing with Kid Dakota and the Mountain Goats. The vocal has this really weird nasal Ozzy Osbourne delivery. The music's a tiny bit mathy, sort of alt-rock, a little bit proggy. There's some synths in there. It's a strange fish. I don't hate it, but even years later, it makes much less impression than songs I used to actively dislike, for example, like Backyard Babies or Feeling, which we'll talk about later. The weird thing is, though, about this band, this was from an EP called Gay? Which was reviewed in the early years of Pitchfork, and it received one of the only 10 out of 10 ratings that publication ever handed out.
And the next album got 9.7.
Yeah, the next album got in their best albums of the 1990s. What's really interesting is, though, that it was then revised out of that list. And we've spoken about this in the Pitchfork Effect mixtape, where Pitchfork goes back in time and edits its history to fit with what was cool and what wasn't cool. So Pitchfork giving 10 out of 10 and then 9.7 out of 10 to a band called 12 Rods that even I, as a bit an enthusiast at this point, can't remember anything about. It's just Pitchfork up to their old tricks, you know. It's pretty annoying. The album definitely... it doesn't merit that rating. They're not.
No.
They're
apparently one band that they are, I think they played with Brainiac.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that would make sense.
So that's like my only touchstone.
That quasi-mattiness, that technicality.
Yeah, you feel like it could be Thule and then it's not.
Yeah, yeah. So I couldn't be arsed with this song at all. And it sounds like Ozzy's worst output kind of thing. But the incongruous thing on the CD with this track comes in at 6 minutes and 19 seconds.
I know. Yeah.
And for a cover mount CD, that's definitely one you're skipping.
Yeah, and you've got bonus content on the CD-ROM to, you know, you're taking up a lot of time.
Yeah.
Going from Idlewild at 1 minute 58 to, you know, Backyard Babies, a nice clean 3 minutes, to 6 minutes 19 with this dirgy Aussie stuff. It was, I don't know who liked this band, apart from Pitchfork.
I didn't even finish it. I didn't even get to the end of the song. It was so boring for me.
So, a gratuitous question marks again, therapy.
Therapy? Spaghetti hearts. Thinking like that, I won't forget any friends. Screw that, forget about that.
Why don't you think about anything like that? Screw that. Legendary band. Legendary Irish outfit for a number of reasons. Screamager, which I think was the title track from the album.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest songs. Could we riff? But
but live.
So why? Weaver, who was first to do this riff? Because that riff.
Crazy Time.
No. Like, every cut in the dog has done it. Like, biggest riff is probably The Offspring, though. What was the tune? The Kids Aren't All Right.
The Kids Aren't All Right.
Yeah, but this was before that.
This was before that.
Yeah. Screamager, was it the progenitor of that riff?
Possibly. You know, so let's.
It seems like a lot of songs sound like it.
Setting aside the sort of cult nature of Therapy for a moment, I don't know about anybody else here, but I always felt a bit shortchanged when I got a live version. You know, if you don't know the band,
especially if they were as probably drunk as they are on this recording,
but see, if you don't know the band, it's usually effectively a lesser version of the tune. If you do know them, okay, I get it, it's fine. I suppose the target was Obsessives, who were somehow swayed into interest by a track they probably already know, but I generally feel like these things were a bit of a missed opportunity. You know, it's a decent rendition. There's nothing particularly different about it, but if
you're a bit sloppy.
In my notes, I've got the drum fills are really fucking wonky on the drummer's part.
Yeah, and he's normally a fairly solid drummer, so.
But it's also, I have the same thoughts about a track that will come up shortly. I just think it's.
Yeah. I think it's an odd choice to do the live thing, and I wonder who decided that. Is that the label? Is that the band? Is that the magazine? Because I feel like there was always one or two live tracks on every compilation, so.
I get the feeling.
Who decided which one was going
to
be that?
This may be one of those breadcrumb things where we can start to piece together how these things came together, because. I suspect that Therapy were asked by the magazine to take part because they were fucking hot shit and cool and a different side of the market, and Therapy were unwilling to give an album track, but they said you can have
You can have which is weird because to me it devalues them because it doesn't sound as good. But for them, they're like, oh, we're not giving away the well-produced track.
That's one of their biggest hits. Why would they put an inferior version of it on it?
Yeah, but then why would they then
some other label?
Why would they then give away a high-resolution version of it when they could put out a teaser? I can kind of see the logic, even though I don't agree with it.
But this is the thing. If you're going to try and get new fans, you want to put a very high-impact song forward. Yeah.
They obviously just also probably believe that their live version is good enough.
Yeah.
Therapy are probably a band that you should probably talk about on a podcast at some point, because they're pretty you know, well known to us, I guess. But you know, looking at that time, 98, like Andy Cairns, he had to have it was a naffest goatee of all time. It was David Brent. He just looks like your pal who works on life insurance and can just had a wane, but then plays in one of the best British bands we've ever had. Like, so Therapy are amazing.
Talking about like strange sort of songs to put forward, Shostakovich by Symposium, the eighth track. Do you remember this band? They were sort of like Nearly Men of Brit Rock, but I guess
I always got mixed up with them between Three Colours Red. but they're not.
Well, see, yeah, so they're of that time, which was just sort of proto Brit rock, right? Because two of them went on to form Hell Is For Heroes.
Yeah, that's right,
actually,
yeah.
one of them went on to do stuff with Hot Chip, I think, as well. Yeah. They were probably forefathers of that. They had unbelievable fucking tours. I mean, this band got so much effort put behind them. They toured with Red Hot Chili Peppers, Foo Fighters, Deftones, and No Doubt. I mean, that is like the biggest fucking bands of that era. And they still
remember they were one of the bands who were known for their live show. I think their singer was I remember seeing them several times. They were always supporting someone, and the guy would just absolutely go hell for leather.
He dislocated his leg on stage.
Yeah,
dislocated his leg during the show.
They got covered a lot in Kerrang as well.
Yeah, they did.
But do you remember Morat, the guy with the mohawk that used to, he was in this issue of Kerrang, he does the singles and gives Symposium 1K out of 5 because he just fucking hates it. So like, they're obviously, he's probably like, oh, why is the editor giving more fucking coverage to this shit band?
So what I think's really weird is, as far as I know, this was not released.
It's not one of the good ones.
But I don't think it was on an album.
I noticed that as well. And it's just by Youth, the album that they did.
Yeah, that's strange as well. Yeah, they've Killing Joke. But
shout out to their name though. I'm very jealous. Symposium from the Greek. It means drinking party.
Yeah, yeah, right. That would have been one you'd have used. But no, I think it's interesting that I think it was a B-side on something, and it's a strange choice again to put as a foot forward. You don't want to give away your album tracks, but I think the thing is, Symposium weren't as heavy as this track makes them sound. Do you know what I mean? The whole thing is a bit cheap because it hinges on that one big and, okay, fairly decent riff. Yeah! But it is just a magnitude beefier than a lot of what they did. For me, they were sort of like weak-voiced, upbeat rock act between A and, you know, Hell Is For Heroes, the band they went on to form. The tune itself, that mid-register scream that the guy does, is admittedly fucking badass. It's a really, really good one. The superstructure of the song around that riff, though, and especially the vocal melodies, are piss weak, so the novelty of that song wore off. I was initially impressed. I remember just loving a good riff back in that day, but it didn't have any lasting appeal, because once you'd heard it, you were like, oh, the fucking melody in this is dog shit.
I thought the production was quite ropey. It sounded like a bit like a demo to me, like maybe they just did it for this compilation.
I think that's what we're going to talk, especially in the next track as well, and as we discussed with Therapy, I think there must have been some kind of deal with, like, we need to have something like 15 to 20 tracks on this cover mount CD, so can I give us what you got? I think that probably explains that Symposium choice, which doesn't represent the band very well. I don't think the Screamager by Therapy live version represented it very well. And I don't think the next one, Catherine Wheel, which is another long live version, really represents
texture
that band very well either. And I'm faced by the
thorn I've been keeping. We've covered Catherine Wheel on the show before.
Yeah, you've talked about it a lot.
Yeah, and Texture was a popular song for fans of theirs. I personally, as much as I advocate for the band, I don't particularly like this song at all, even in the studio version. As we said with Therapy, I find it perplexing because, especially if you play watery, weak-kneed stuff like this tune, you gotta let your audience know what you actually sound like, especially in a rock magazine. So you want a studio-produced song with a bit of power behind it, because as much as I don't like the song very much, the studio version is beefy and it's very shoegazy and very saturated.
It sounds like Jarvis Cocker doing shoegaze, and really fucking forgettable.
I mean, I remember it being on here back in the day. I do remember listening to it, and it didn't get me on board with them. Yet I got into the band later, so they failed in that respect. They had an audience that was sympathetic to them, and they didn't get me when I was right there in front of them. So it was a bad choice. You know what I mean? It just was a bad choice.
Yeah.
I can imagine it going across okay, maybe in the NME or the Melody Maker, but I never really saw it hoovering up many other casual Kerrang readers.
Yeah, he didn't want it on a metal magazine. Side note for Weaver here, the singer is Bruce Dickinson's cousin.
Yeah, that's so. Right, isn't it? Yeah,
maybe Matt Dickinson. Just got in there because of that.
Well, his voice is dreadful on this. It's a really bad... Just a really bad live.
Just a bad recording.
Song.
The guitars don't sound nice.
Yeah. I'm just surprised this kind of recording would be allowed on a cover mount.
Aye, yeah, totally.
That they must have really been scraping the barrel with the budget or the deal that they had with the labels to say, yeah, we need this on it, because anyone listening to this would go, unless you're a massive Catherine Wheel fan and really looking for those live intricacies, you're not gonna get anything.
Yeah, who benefits from them being on this? I don't know.
The next song.
Who benefits from this being on?
Yeah, I can't help myself by Felines. Were female singers even allowed?
Just the one.
Just feline. One cat.
I've got one cat now as well. Were female singers even allowed at this period of rock
music?
Yeah,
no. You know, a bit like Backyard Babies, there was always some kind of blues-tinged, punky, snot and roll act around for all the guys over 40 with leather jackets. And yes, I am now a guy over 40.
I'm almost one of them.
Leather jackets. That's also why I feel like this tune actually probably aged better than most since that.
Well, funnily enough, a support band at a punk gig last night sounded exactly like this. Just exactly.
It's a timeless sound.
And I was
sound.
Like, oh, well, there you are. They're still doing this.
In my notes here, I said, this is a definition of a Kerrang CD band.
Yeah,
all
totally.
The big festivals. They had all the big supporting gigs and all that, and they just went nowhere. I would say I've never even heard of them.
Yeah, I don't think I heard of them.
I don't mind the track, to be fair. I think the track's pretty good. Produced by Chris Sheldon, but still sounds pretty
Biffy.
Amateur. Kind of 80s, kind of Susie vibes.
Yeah, yeah.
But the guitars are just a bit too scooped for that sound, though. It kind of ruins something that could have been cooler. Like, it's not the worst track on the CD. And the end of it actually goes kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Kind of that kind of precursor to kind of yeah, yeah, yeahs, kind of well. But if the guitars hadn't been so scooped, it would have been a hell of a lot cooler. But yeah, who are this band?
It does a genre thing well without being spectacular, right? The main songwriter in the band was called Grog. Her real name was Georgina Preble. They did two albums as a band, and then somebody, I think it was a record company on their management team, persuaded them to change their name to Ultraviolet so they could re-sign to a different record label. But the whole thing backfired and the band just ended up collapsing. I have actually heard this band before. They did a cover of the song Air That I Breathe by the Hollies. For a compilation album, a double compilation album called Come Again, which was a kind of covers collection, and that was easily one of the best covers on that, along with the Sparkle Horse Tom York version, I Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd. You know what, I think this band probably did have something there. Actually, I think it's quite charismatic.
Do you know what Grog did next?
What?
Grog, well, first of all, did some session work as a live bassist with Mel C., and Kelly Osbourne.
That's right, aye.
But then she also started another band called Daiso Fluid.
Ah, that's right, yeah.
So, and they supported Drowning Pool, Vex Red, Feeder, Boy Hits Car, The Wild Heart. Yeah, kept going for like an. Well, I think they are genuinely still going. Die So Fluid. So there you go. Well done, Grog.
Addict, Caned. You know,
That's Stone Temple Pilots, isn't it?
Well,
it sounds very much of its era.
I just thought it was like
octave chords, you know?
Yeah, that it's like that Bush early feeder sort of shit.
Yeah, so they actually draw Bush comparisons in a few things. They were described in a few forums as post-grunge. The Stones album that they brought out had a lot of Bush moments on it. I don't remember a lot of that. I remember seeking these guys out on the basis of this on the CD though, because I mean obviously I was a mark for grunge stuff back then, so it's worked in that sense. I mean, I do remember getting at least a single. I don't remember them doing a lot after that. Did I maybe catch them at a show? I think so. I think they sound a lot like Hell Is For Heroes, more so than some of the grunge comparisons.
Yeah, I think that's a slight on Bush. Like, I think Bush are a lot better than this band. You know, this is another one of those examples of a completely forgettable band. And again, like, I'm really surprised at the quality of the recording. Like, the vocals go all over the shop.
Horrible.
Pretty fucked up parts.
Horrible.
The overall mix is just all over the place, and it's just, like I say, another fine example of a completely forgettable band, even though, you know, you totally remember Bush. But I'm sure there's some drug addict in a pub in Camden right now telling some wee lassie that he was in a band called Addict.
So, allegedly.
Still to this day.
So, but here's the thing, right? That dodgy recording quality actually really defined the early days of Hell Is For Heroes, yet they managed to benefit from it. Their first couple of singles...
Because they had riffs, yeah.
Yeah, but their first singles were really popular, yet were fucking terribly recorded. I mean, I think actually Addict make a slightly better job of things than Symposium, for what it's worth.
Yeah, I agree.
Believe it or not, by the way, I found a Washington Post review of Addict, right? So they must have been doing something right, which was very complimentary. It had some interesting reflections, like Aston, I can't remember the guy's first name, has an aptitude for melody that suggests Britpop more than Black Sabbath. They've produced a credible hard rock album that has nimbly negotiated a course between cliche and bombast. I mean, I think it's all right. I definitely wouldn't go out my way to find it now, but back in the day, this hit the mark. I went and got it, and being that I was a fucking grunge poster child, still am, sitting here.
This song reminds me of learning guitar, you know, learning chords, and just kind of going up from the 5 to the 7 and learning bands like Addict or Silverchair or Year 2000, things like that. Down, down, you know?
Just... Right, Craig, you take the fucking lead. Clawfinger. Stop my head, it's stuck right on my mind.
Yeah, to our Swedish correspondent over here.
Right, so some more Swedish stuff that I have absolutely no recollection of.
No way,
I can't say I like it much.
Clawfinger seem to be a band that a lot of people know and then a lot of people have literally never heard of.
That's mad, Craig. I thought you would have been a fucking absolute mark for these guys.
Clawfiend.
Nah, their message is far too healthy for me back in those days.
Clawfingered. 2 steps forward and 1 step back. The time will come when you lose track.
Massively anti-racist band, pretty healthy message throughout.
A massively anti-racist band that were the victims of entirely the opposite because of their single titled N-word.
Yeah.
They won a couple of Swedish Grammys.
Yeah, they did. But go on their YouTube channel and it is a fucking nightmare because the comments are absolutely riddled with people that did not see the irony in the title of that song. Less problem to worry about. That's the way they do it. This is how it turns out. For all with the American government, I wanna know where all the goddamn money went. We didn't see it and it didn't do no good. I guess you couldn't give a fuck about a black neighborhood. So there's a whole host of Clawfinger fans on there trying to put people to rights. Like, you're not fucking welcome here. This track's called that because they don't believe that and you should fuck off. And it's just a total midden. What I do remember about Clawfinger...
That's an enigma, yeah.
Yeah. What I do remember about Clawfinger was that they had a single called Two Sides that I actually quite liked, which had this really strong Arabian thing through it with a female, Middle Eastern vocal in the chorus. Yeah. That line, "I don't believe in a goddamn need to worship" thing was totally hooky. They were like this very atheistic band, you know. Actually, as bad as they are in hindsight, and I'm aware of the fact that they're fucking stodgy, I remember actually really liking it. Do you know they're still a band?
Yep.
They're still a fucking fully operational thing. They're working on a project to re-record the entire Deaf, Dumb, Blind album that had that N-word single on it with a series of guest players, including two members of Rammstein. The only thing is, I get the feeling that project's been in development for about 14 years and it probably will never happen.
So most of the tunes on this CD, this one is really dated of its time. You know that kind of siren effect in the background?
Yep.
And they've got a bunch of kind of electronic effects on it. It really dates it.
Yeah, it's that industrial new metal time. Crossover.
Totally, yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Only from 1997.
it's not the worst of the songs in the album, but it's really dated.
This song is so new metal that I feel like I can actually smell how sweaty these guys were. Mm-hmm. I just want to put them in a shower.
No, these guys lived in communes. That's what happened. It wasn't the largesse of new metal, I don't think. But yeah, they threw enough shit at the wall. As you were saying, Chris, they tried to bring in other influences and
I get the feeling these guys were held in pretty high regard. You know, certainly their anti-racist thing aged well. They were ahead of the pack on a lot of the messaging, because let's not forget that fucking new metal was a misogynistic, quite homophobic, fucking very white guy, with exceptions, but very white guy-led genre, right? Mm-hmm. And Clawfinger at least were bringing a sort of like, almost like the punk scene sort of messaging to the new metal scene. And kudos for that, at least. Can we agree?
But I wonder how they got on this compilation, because they're a bit of an outlier there.
For Sweden.
They sold a lot of records.
just a Swedish thing, yeah.
Everybody that was in a band in Sweden is on this compilation. Let's get fucking serious.
A banger coming up next.
Oh, Fu Manchu, Evil Eye. Fu Manchu are fucking great. Like, I really like Fu Manchu, even now.
It's a standout on this one.
A stoner rock band that were different for the likes of the other stoner rock bands. They weren't like Nebula. They had, again, that skateboarding affiliation. They were a lot cooler and breezier and lighter and...
Oh, yeah. Isn't the album cover of this...
Yeah, guy
on a
skateboard.
Action is Go is the album.
Yeah, and they appeared on
this one?
A lot of skating videos and stuff as well. Yeah. You know, those kind of compilation videos used to be on Channel 5. It's a great tune. Badass fucking tones in it. I heard this first, but I didn't actually get into Fu Manchu until Trapeze Freak, which was, I think, an earlier song. But it was for me a better access point. I think I got it on a tape of a Bruce Dickinson Radio 1 show, and years later it really clicked to me, and I went back and got into Action Is Go and Evil Eye and all those kind of tunes. Fucking great band. They're almost certainly going to be in an episode at some point.
Am I right in saying, Chris, that these guys, I assumed they were British for some reason, because they were
California.
A staple of those mid-level tours. They were on, they were like the Skindred or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, looking into it, it was like, oh, fuck, they're American. Mm. And it's Brant York from Caius in there as well. So, absolute fucking cred to them. But, I guess, you know, quality fucking rises to the top as well. And this is one of the top tunes on the CD, I would say.
Speaking of top tunes.
Right, let's okay, this is interesting. Track 14, Psychor's Full Blood Freak.
Once again, our Swedish contingent.
Yeah, no. Now, I remember them to fuck because the guy was a big bald cunt and he had the mad tattoo.
Did he?
Aye. And I just remember that because I don't think I ever listened
to
them.
They had a look.
They had a vibe.
You know what?
Swedish correspondent here says, I have no clue about, and they're completely forgettable.
But the thing is, this
fucking trash.
This is not the right version. Or this is not the version that's on the album. To do it for the kids out there, to kill it, to do it. Yeah, this is a reprise version.
Yeah,
and it's like half like half the time. This doesn't actually sound like them.
They're a heavy band.
1 minute 31 seconds.
So
why is it on there?
So here's the thing, right? A couple of theories here. This could be a mistake.
Yeah, maybe they just sent over the wrong file.
Because this is a reprise of the actual song.
1 minute 31.
Yeah, and they went to all that trouble. That said, right, Psycore, there's something to me really fucking compelling and interesting about this band, because they make no fucking sense, okay? For starters, this tune sounds so much like a Betty era song by Helmet that was called The Silver Hawaiian, which is the same thing. It's sort of in the album as a reprise, and it honestly, I'll put it in here, it sounds very, very similar, right? And it's not just the fact that they both used the piccolo snare. It's not just the kind of vaguely comedic spoken word sort of lowrider vibes, you know. It's just there's a creepy kind of weird eccentricity of this band. And as I say, going back, I'm really curious about this band. I think I will spend a little bit of time listening to them. They may be ghastly, right? They had a crappily animated faux manga video for a song that I think was their biggest one called I Go Solo. I listen if you're sad, when you're mad or such. One time is okay, a billion times are a bit too much. It was on MTV too a lot at the time.
The Zoo was another big one.
Was it?
Yeah.
Right, okay. This song's really odd, sort of compelling though, in that bizarreness. The Wikipedia for them, by the way, says the specific time of their disbandment is not known. and it's worth noting that Psycore, by the way, is also shorthand for psychedelic trance music, and thus if you go on YouTube there's loads of those super long videos with shit animations designed for like Thai beach parties and stuff like that. But
so I've got a theory on this one.
Okay,
and you've talked about this in previous episodes. It's about the running time of how much shit you can get onto the actual disc.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah,
and I think they were speaking with the Swedish consulate and said, okay, we've got all these bands on it, and it's like, we have 1 minute 31 seconds left on this disc.
Do any of your bands have that? Yeah, totally.
And then it was just absolutely shoehorned in there.
Yeah, we've used all 744 megabytes.
It goes back to, and probably also goes back to partly what Dave was saying. It's like they're probably part of a package with another band on the label.
Yeah, yeah. And but like, with that, why choose this song though? Why choose this song?
Probably because of the time. I reckon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I reckon totally. This is probably 48 minutes long, almost exactly this CD.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing is though, there has to be a counterproductive factor here where people heard Psycho and went, "That's that fucking weird song." Well,
I read a good review, but that sounds pish.
Yeah, I don't want to go and see them or hear them again.
Yeah,
and
totally.
It's actually putting your worst foot forward in the sense of, I don't think it's the worst fruit, I think it's actually quite interesting, but I do think it's counterproductive if you don't sound like it, you know what I mean?
The guitarist ended up joining Leather Nun.
Yeah, funnily enough, I was going to say, we don't have a Nexus this episode, but Leather Nun
are the ultimate
are
Nexus
an
band.
Ultimate Nexus band. Yeah. So.
Okay, last track in the album. This is an interesting one, right? And as of last night, I was treading very fucking cautiously about this, right? Because we had a really strange coincidence of timing in this, right? First of all, the song's really bad. There's no getting away from it, right?
So let's talk about what the band are called, Freakspert, and this track is called Freaky Ones. So this reminds me a lot of what was going on at the time. The best of it probably being bands like Downset, that kind of good music with a kind of a rappy thing over it. And then the worst of it, in my eyes, being like Limp Bizkit. But I know a lot of people like Limp Bizkit. We've talked about them quite a lot on this because it's 1998. So I don't really recall this band, Freakspert, with two E's, but I've probably seen them with someone like, you know, Vacant Stare or Number One Son.
1 minute
or,
silence.
You know, around those time. Yeah, 1 minute silence, Kill to This, all that, you know. I didn't know it was a Scottish guy, but then listening to this song, you know, See the Animals in the Jungle, it's very much in a kind of Scottish vein.
Look out your window, you can feel the neighbors swear. Let me be the sweeper, so not tell me you really care. Got my big lessons down, and when
when we were talking in advance, you said you've got a you've got an origin story,
yeah,
or something coming on.
The plot thickened, right? Because there's not a lot out about this band, and there's not a lot of music out in the ether. There's a really, really tough going live video of them performing, right? But first of all, I found out that the drummer came from a Christian metal band called Seventh Angel.
Also, thrash metal band. They were all music for
a
nations.
Thrash metal band, right? But Christian thrash metal band, which is definitely also a strip club called Seventh Angel, right? But they, I think the David's pulled up some artwork.
You can
from
get, you can buy the album on eBay, and it's, well, the album's called Ice Scream, and it's just got
clever.
It's got like a big plastic ice cream on the front, down at, you know, the beach arcade or whatever, and the font is like,
yeah, it's like spray paint, like
I mean, it looks like Goldie Looking Chain or something.
So here's the thing, right? So you said Downset, and I think Downset are a different proposition to this, right? Downset were a sort of like hardened ghetto proper gangbanging heavy
Downset were just a band I really loved at the time, and again, I keep saying this, but that's probably one you should talk about, because I can't imagine many people listening to this will have heard of Downset.
No, but I mean, Downset are kind of OG in the sense that they're the real deal. This is like, but as we found out, a Scottish guy, and they're
this
one
is
of the
Argoths.
Yeah, exactly, the Argoths. I was saying that this is like one step off. Remember Marek's band from Stirling?
I think every town had a band like this, the new metal band,
exactly. And so it turns out, beyond that drummer for the Christian metal band, one of the vocalists in this is a guy named McGee from Stirling, and the reason I found that is because underneath one of their videos on YouTube, he's chatting with one of their fans. He fucking put up his phone number.
Did you call him?
Right, so here's the thing, right? So he puts up his phone number, and I was, it's a bad live video, and I was like, okay, I suppose we could ring him to find out, right? And then I'm like, me, Craig and I grew up in Stirling, and I'm like, If there was a guy getting on the Kerrang compilation CDs, man, I would have assumed we would have known who the fuck that guy was, right?
No idea.
Exactly.
No idea.
So it turns out he had a few projects. At one point, he had the same manager as Maloko. I got that off his Facebook. Anyway, so things started to get a bit grim, right? So I was trying to verify if I had the right guy, and I was trying to see if I knew who he was. And fuck me, man, that boy, by the way, he seems like a lovely guy. I will say that first and foremost. Like, his posts were so fucking good natured, and it seems like a real dude. He had a rough year. I don't know how much it was to do with COVID, but he's lost members of his family, and fucking all the best to the guy. And you know, one of the things we spoke about when we were doing this was, how do people's lives go after these CDs? I mean, this guy, he did do other projects. I know that from what he's posted, but I get the feeling this was like one of the kind of like peak moments of that. And where did the folk end up after this? And actually yesterday, you know, people were a bit concerned about his well-being, and, you know, I hope the guy's doing well. I do not like this music at all, but it was kind of fascinating to get that little moment of insight, inadvertent insight, into what happened to some of these folk that weren't Max Cavalera, what happened to some of these folk that weren't Roddy Wimble, where did they fucking end up, and what are they doing with themselves now? And the fact is, I mean, he's probably a far nicer guy for the looks of things than a lot of these people probably ended up being, but with so many of these bands, the bands like 12 Rods, like, it is interesting to think about them just sort of sinking back into the ether after this one little thing. You know, with Psycho, or where the Wikipedia is like, we don't even know when they split up. And that kind of thing is really fascinating. What happened to these folk, you know? I just want to say as well, though, before we move on, the boy's good. He's all right. He's back online today. He's in good shape. He was watching some more tunes and posting them up. So that's why I feel comfortable enough talking about it.
That actually comes back to what we were talking about in the Enemy episode, right? Is this whole nostalgia thing?
Yeah, so I've been watching a lot of kind of B-movie documentaries on musicians and stuff on Amazon Prime. Documentaries on bands that I don't particularly like very much, like Semisonic or Wheatus and all the rest of it, seeing their journey.
Jesus.
And yeah, and these are bands who've had their time in the sun, but then what happened afterwards? For some people, like we're talking about Freakspert here, you know, this might have been the highlight of their career, you know, Feline, Addict, you know, this might have been the highest circulation they got. So
yeah,
I don't know, how does that nostalgia go now?
Yeah, it led to their appearance at Download or Reading, and you know, all their pals went, and that was a big fucking time in their life.
You'd take it.
Super right. Highlights. Yeah, totally. Yeah, you definitely take it. But nowadays, it's this whole nostalgia trip, as you were talking about on the In Me episode, about, you know, there's all these festivals that are completely dedicated to that.
Yeah, not even just that, but like things like crowdfunding platforms can sustain bands like In Me and like Demisonic and stuff like that. Well, Demisonic are an interesting case because Dan Wilson's like a big songwriter in Hollywood, like basically for huge artists, but Semisonic also had to play his music, you know, and they were raising money for their record, obviously just for the fans that still remember them. So that, I guess there are some bands that can rise back out because they've had just enough level of fame where they can kind of still cut onto something. And are bands like the ones we've just spoken about, like Psychor and Freakspert and all that, which just, it was 15 minutes of fame and then it just burnt out completely.
So fingers crossed, if you're travelling around festivals in the north of England this summer, you might catch Heather Smalls, Toya Wilcox and Freakspert.
Oh, that would be fucking class. Hamilton Racecourse.
when I learned to ice skate, it was Moving On Up by M People playing on the jukebox at the Stirling Ice Rink. Chris, I'm sure you've been there.
Yeah, I learned to skate to the song from Dirty Dancing, Time of My Life.
An absolute belter.
Sexy.
Okay, so another bonus item here. This was an enhanced CD. Did anybody know that?
Yeah, this was like one of the first.
Yeah.
So like they all started doing enhanced content.
Yep.
I remember sometimes they would have demos of shoot 'em up games and stuff like that. I remember, yeah.
But nope, with this one we got Loco, the video for Loco by Cold Chamber. And not, I might add, the full resolution video for Loco by Cold Chamber, but what looks like someone with a Nokia 3210 has filmed the video for Loco on another Nokia 3210.
240 max.
Did you know this was Jack White's first film appearance? Jack White plays the creepy milkman who,
no, he doesn't.
Who puts the holiday pictures on the old...
no, he doesn't.
What's it called?
Craig, he does not. He doesn't.
He does. It's Jack White.
No, it's no.
Watch the video. It's Jack White in 32-bit.
I totally forgot that Cold Chamber were managed by Sharon Osbourne. Like,
oh wow,
that explains a lot.
Because they were shit.
Yeah, this is the best song.
Yeah,
you know this song sounds just as amateur as Mine and Weaver's High School Bands.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like you go back and you obviously listen to Korn, you listen to Soulfly, you listen to a lot of these new metal bands. Although it's dated, they were at least fucking good musicians. But whenever I listen to Cold Chamber, I'm just like, they are rubbish. Mm-hmm. And like all parts of it are rubbish. And I just feel that they were just taken and managed the fuck out of and given all these opportunities.
Yeah. You see, the mad thing is, I have no qualitative opinion on Cold Chamber in the sense of, as musicians, I've just never even considered it. I'm like, are they really rubbish? Are they not just playing rubbish music?
No, they're rubbish.
I once seen a Des far and the Wimpy on Union Street.
Oh wow!
Devil Driver were playing a show at the Cat House or something, and he was in the burger shop downstairs, and I was like, oh, I just find it hilarious somehow. So
I actually had a CDR copy of this album that somebody gave me in school.
Oh wow!
And it is fucking even back then it was fucking garbage.
It all comes out.
Yeah, I mean, I loved new metal, and I was just not
so quick.
At all.
Quick survey, but Craig, the good, the bad and the ugly, given that the ugly you can make it whatever you want.
Okay, so the good probably has to be Soulfly. No bow to none, no follow none, no redaction. Any song that starts with an just like really appealed to me at the time when I was feeling like in a teenage rage. It's probably aged kind of terribly, but fuck it. It still gets me excited, and it's probably the only metal song to reference Hootie and the Blowfish. So kudos to that.
Probably.
But it was really close to the hop between Idlewild, Fu Manchu, and Backyard Babies for me. The not would be probably 12 Rods Red. I just didn't dig it at all. I hate his voice more than a 95-year-old Aussie. Sounds like it was recorded on a fucking crisp packet too. Just Yeah, that's the not for me. The what would be, as discussed, Psycore, Full Blood Freak. It's just kind of slovenly as fuck and not in a good way. Slam, goddamn, without the slamming and the goddamming. It just didn't really go anywhere. And just incongruously kind of short. And it's just like a weird wee interlude track you would have in an album. So I don't really see why it would be on this compilation CD. So that's the what with a question mark, much like Therapy.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's my hot not and what.
Dave?
What about you guys?
Well, I have to say, it's what's interesting is looking back on it, there's not actually that much real metal like on this. It's like a lot of grunge and a lot of, you know, true. Like there's no extreme metal or thrash or anything, you know, so I missed that. But funnily enough, my favourite would have been Idlewild's Self-Healer because it's like just the best fucking track on it. Well, the thing that I fucking hated was probably Addict, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I just hated how beige, and like, it was nearly fucking stereophonic sort of shit. And then the what? I'm going for Freaksbert because it was kind of funny. It was a bit of patter, and to me it was like, yeah, nu metal, but they were not being serious. There was like that sort of bouncy Incubus Crazy Town vibe. But I mean, it's terrible, but I thought it was fun at least. It was a lot more fun than Addict.
Okay,
off.
Mark?
The best song is the same as Dave, Idlewild. It's just the best song in the compilation, full stop. And like Dave, the worst song is Addict. It's beige in the same sense that the interior of a 1998 Ford Escort is beige. It's like, it's just sort of what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
And the what is Loco by Cold Chamber because they took it so fucking seriously. It was a video that wasn't really sort of capital. I watched it in full HD on YouTube just to get the full experience, and it was just...
I watched it in 240 on Real Player.
Jack White was really good in it, though.
Yeah, oh, yeah, he started the show. And I had to download QuickTime again.
Yeah, they just took it far too seriously for me. They take it far too seriously. Like, and I was like, that's the whole, what? Like, you understand what's happening here, right? Even in the 90s, the late 90s, you must understand how ridiculous this is, but nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
The best song is Addict. you know what? I might have said
You're
that
just
back.
A troll.
I might have said that back in the day. I think the best band is Fu Manchu. It's not their best song, but then again, Self-Healer's not Idlewild's best song. Self-Healer probably made a bigger impact, so I'll say that as well. The not, I mean, I really, at the time, I really hated Backyard Babies, so maybe I said that, but I think in the long, I mean, the Freaksbert song's terrible, and the 12 Rods one's fucking just a total non-event. I don't know what the fuck it's doing there. And the what? I'm probably going to say Psychor as well, because I think it's on there as a mistake. I think it's totally counterproductive because we're all like, oh, this is terrible. What's the point of it? As Dave said, it's a reprise. That whole, you know, slam goddamn, the proper version or the main part of the album sounds nothing like this. It's twice the speed. So there's some really anomalous about it, but also the eccentricity of Psychor and the weird incongruity of them amidst that scene. I just find that really quite compelling, and they may be horrendous, but I am going to go and investigate them a wee bit further to see what the fuck they were all about.
A last comment on these Covermint CDs is something, it maybe didn't start until maybe around 2000, where you would get tracks by bands that were remixes done by DJs, and it'd be like digital samurai remix of fucking, you know, like a Sepultura song or a Fear Factory song or something like that.
Yeah.
And they became the tracks that you would skip, and they would always be like tracks 16, 17 and all the rest of it as well. So it's probably for further discussion, but that was just a fucking horrible time for music.
That's maybe analogous to the live tracks, you know, the remixes.
Yeah, yeah. They'll have had a bit of budget to fill out maybe B-sides and stuff, and they're like, all right, let's stick this.
Cool. Right. Good shift, guys. That was the first of our as yet unnamed recurring segment where we look at these cover discs.
And we'll do this again.
Yeah. And
it won't always be Kerrang.
No. But we'll take it from I mean, we're looking at, in my very room,
we've got some doozies.
A pile of horrendous cover discs.
You have been in your ma's attic.
See, we never mentioned this, right? But when I went to the charity shops looking for these, the Covermount CDs are so worthless to the public now that the charity shops won't even sell them. I remember when they used to always be in there, and now they are so devoid of value that they will not even stock them in boxes. I found one shop that had like a couple of shelves devoted to these, and they were like 20p each, take 40 for a quid sort of thing, right? Except when you go online, you find that some of them, especially those things like the C81 or the certain ones of the Kerrang, the curated ones, you know, they're actually quite sought after by enthusiasts. So it's quite a strange little...
It's like, a new Bitcoin. Fucking government.
Yeah.
You got it here first.
Yep. All right, Craig. Thanks very much, as ever.
No worries.
Hope you enjoy the rest of your day. We've watched the sun rise upon your beautiful face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it has. It's 9:08 a.m. now.
A valiant shift.
Very, very nice to see you.
10:08 p.m. now for us.
Thanks for that global logistics information, Mark. I'm glad you got through it.
So what we've got coming up next week is a meaty two-parter.
Hefty.
We are doing the Beach Boys,
courtesy of Vicky. That's our choice, and we are going to get, oh my God, what a lot of research. Going to get dug into the career and the lunacy and the brilliance and the cheeriness of the Beach Boys.
Yep, it's going to be fun.
I look forward to that.
Yeah,
good on you. Anyway, keep up the good work, boys, and best of luck, and I'll talk to you next time. Hopefully next time we're doing a Metal Hammer one.
Goodbye, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Peace out.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.